You're listening to a Left Lion podcast.
Welcome to episode 14 of the Left Lion Interviews podcast. My name is Jared Wilson and I am the editor-in-chief and co-founder of Left Lion. I'm delighted to introduce today's guest, Hattane Patel. Hattane is an English visual artist specialising in performance, sculpture, video and photography. In terms of disciplines, he's something of a polymath, and we'll talk about his experiments with different art forms later on. Hattane first came to Nottingham in 2000 as a fine art student, and he spent more than a decade living here before spreading his wings, exhibiting in Norway, India, Belgium and more. He was born and brought up in Bolton, and in a 2019 interview with The Guardian, he spoke to them at length about being part of the only brown family in town, and about how he regularly received racial abuse that led him to question his identity as a British-born second-generation immigrant. His work is influenced by identity, by his family's Indian heritage, and by mainstream Western pop culture. For his 2014 show American Boy, he showcased a range of influences from mainstream American movies, swirling together snippets of Bruce Lee, Batman, Spider-Man, Gladiator, American Psycho, and much more, into a piece reflecting upon his own identity. A year later, for the film The Jump, he dressed as Spider-Man and recreated a scene from his childhood home wearing a very special Spidey suit. More about that later, although I probably ought to mention that if you haven't yet seen the 2025 James Gunn-directed Superman film, there are some spoilers from me towards the end. Hattane is back in Notts on Saturday the 1st of November with his latest work, Matru Basha. That's at the Lakeside Arts Centre as part of Not Dance for Festival 2025.
Hi, this is Sophie from Left Lion, Nottingham's iconic culture magazine. Each month we publish a beautiful free magazine that shines a light on the art, music, food, literature and more that makes Nottingham such a vibrant and creative city to live in. It's a bit unusual for a local print magazine to exist these days, but we've managed to keep going for over 20 years, giving the city's artists, photographers and writers a platform to publish their work. We distribute 15,000 copies in over 300 venues across the county, and you can find Left Lion in every local library, every Castle Rock pub, in all active Nottingham leisure centres, and all the best bars, cafes and hangouts in Nottingham. If you're ever in town at the start of the month, you may have seen our Left Lion bike rolling around the streets. In line with our pledge to be a carbon neutral company, we deliver our magazines on foot, by electric bicycle or where strictly necessary, by van. You can also read the full magazine and lots more for free at leftlion.co.uk. Check out the events listings on our website to find out what's going on in Notts, and if you'd like to promote your business or organisation with us, please visit leftlion.co.uk/advertise.
So let's start off. Tell me about the new work, Matru Basha. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, Matru Basha. It's it means mother tongue in Gujarati, which is the language my family have, if you like. My family's origin language, and it's a live performance. It's a solo performance by me, and it's based on interviews I've been doing with my family members. At the moment, it's different generations of women, and talking about heritage, ancestry, language, food, kind of those things that, I guess the thing that started all this is, you know, in recent years, the immigrant generation in my family, who sort of came over in the late 60s, are dying, you know, they're kind of aging out. And so, you know, my generation in my family is the first British-born generation. So, you know, you sort of start to panic a bit. Like, you know, when that generation's gone, what are we losing? You know, what do we want to keep? What have we been a bit slack on? Do you know what I mean? You know, and so, you know, things like language, food, recipes, rituals, rites. And so it comes from sort of thinking about those things and then interviewing. I want to kind of get around everyone eventually, but interviewing some people in my family about those things, And they're different generations of people. So they're from the immigrant generation, like my mum and my auntie, to my generation of one of my cousins, to the next generation, my niece, and kind of chatting about those things. And so I've used those interviews as kind of a almost like a musical structure for me then to perform to. So I use the rhythm of those words, put music to it, and I perform to those. Sometimes it's physical, kind of dance based, and sometimes it's with text. So sometimes I speak the words in sync with them, and sometimes I sing their words. And you know, it's partly about this idea of the body as archive, you know, kind of wanting to archive my family stories, you know, to remember them, you know, in thinking about how we pass things down. But also kind of when I interview, when, you know, you'll know from yourself in what you do, when you interview people, they kind of tend to say things more or deeper or wider than they would if you're having a chat, you know, outside or, you know, at a family gathering or whatever it is. And so I also learn about my family. And that's kind of what my artwork's about in some ways. And so I get to take those stories and perform them and kind of make almost a ritual out of them.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I think it and it transfers across any culture, really, doesn't it? I've been thinking a lot recently. So we're probably about the same age. In fact, I think I'm 46 and you're early 40s, right?
Yeah,
And you do
I'm
start to
44.
think that your mum and dad aren't going to be here forever. And I know that, you know, my father, for example, I've been doing little video interviews with him, and not for any publication, just to just my kids, really. You know, and to keep those things in the family, because you're aware that time starts to pass quicker, right?
That's right. That's right. And it's a strange thing because one of my biggest regrets is that I didn't do those interviews with my grandmother before she passed. And you know, I don't have any grandparents anymore. And I did think about it in the years before she died, even longer than that. But I always felt morbid. You know, I don't know if you ever had that feeling when you're interviewing your dad. But you know, I felt I didn't do anything because I thought, oh, it feels bad to be like interviewing you before you die. Even though I don't know when that's going to be, you know, in terms of preservation, you're still alive, you know. So I never did it, but I really regret it. I really regret it. So, you know, I think it was also one of the impetuses for this performance. It's like, no, get around, interview people, you know, record our stories.
I mean, it's so much easier now with the technology as well, isn't it? You don't have to write all the notes down and fact check it. It's kind of, you can almost put it on a server or in the cloud and just leave it for a few years, you know?
Exactly. It's also kind of
So
like,
this isn't.
sorry,
Sorry.
I was
No,
going to say
you talk.
it's also, you know, because it's dance and it's about the body in a way. I think about the body a lot. You know, I'm kind of an analog guy because of my generation, I guess. And nowadays there is just so much stuff digitally, audibly, visually, physically that enters our bodies, our minds, without permission. You know, and we sort of get made by this stuff and confused by this stuff and messed up by this stuff. So, you know, part of this process is trying to decide what do I want in my body, you know, in my mind and my muscles and my nervous system. And so spending so much time listening to people in my family and then spending time repeating their interviews and learning them, physically in movement. But also their words, like you're learning a prayer or a song over and over again. It's about being conscious about that choice. You know, if I think about my ancestry, people I've never met generations before me, what are those things in my body that or my mind or my soul that are there from that? Hard to know, isn't it? But I kind of feel like a place to start is the people that are around now. And so it's kind of being conscious about putting that into yourself. And so you know, the process of this performance is about that as well.
So, I mean, your family plays quite a big part in your work, doesn't it? I remember seeing Jump, which was 2015, right? Loved it, by the way. Big Spider-Man fan myself.
Yes.
How do your family react to seeing themselves in your work?
I mean, they love it. They absolutely love it. You know, they're big supporters of my work. They come to my shows. I think in the instance that you're talking about, where they see themselves in the gallery space, it's a really powerful thing. You know, when you grow up in a marginalized community, as marginalized people, you know, to go into a gallery, which is these spaces that we're told are important spaces of culture, and for them to see it an opening, people, you know, crowding to see them on screen and watching them over and over, huge cinematically. That's a powerful thing, you know, and, you know, gallery audiences are typically white middle class audiences. And so, you know, being witnessed, being acknowledged, being revered, as art, it, and, you know, not in an abstract way, but this is the jump is shot in my grandmother's home. You know, they're wearing their own clothes. They're sat on the sofas we grew up on, where, you know, I'm jumping onto the carpet that's been there for decades. You know, so it's taking the ordinariness of our life and you know, putting a twist on it for sure, but that is the kind of focal point in this place of high culture that they're coming to. So it you know, it's quite a thing.
For our listeners to explain, it was a Hussein with his jumping off the sofa in a really elaborate Spider-Man costume that you created. And am I right in thinking, so all your family were dressed, you know, in really, I think you told them to dress like it was a wedding, right?
That's right, that's right.
And they didn't know you were going to dress as Spider-Man and just jump off the sofa, did they?
No, they didn't. You know, they're really good sports, actually. You know, I just said, like, whoever's available on that weekend, can you please turn up dressed as if you're going to go to a wedding? I'm going to bring a film crew and we're going to do something fun. And they didn't really ask any questions. They were just like, yeah, okay. And they showed up. And so, you know, it was like very film setty, you know, lots of gear, lots of lighting and cameras and, you know, a small crew and all this sort of thing. So it was interesting and it was exciting. And again, it does a similar thing to that gallery experience in a way of all of this fuss and equipment and whatever is there to, yeah, record me as Spidey, but also them, you know. And so, yeah, it was a really memorable experience, I would say.
I'm interested as well because obviously it was like 6 seconds, wasn't it? And then you looped it to 6 minutes. Is that about right? So obviously I guess it was all in the post-production, but it was beautiful. Like it, the way, you know, that amazing soundtrack, that moving photo effect of you just, you know, really slowed down, and then your family's reactions and their faces. It was wonderful, wonderful.
It was kind of, you know, when I was jumping off the sofa as a kid, that was the first sofa I jumped off as a kid. And so I wanted to, and but you know, when you're a kid, you believe it, don't you? It's not fake, or it's not for Insta or whatever. You just believe it in your heart and soul when you jump off a sofa, and that you're Spider-Man or whoever, right? And so I thought, what would it take for me to believe it now as an adult? And in a way, it's all of the trappings of the movie magic. You know, it's when I watch a Spider-Man film, and, you know, or at least the initial ones, that I was in awe. I was like just taken away, and I was like, you know, I want it to be even slower when he jumps. You know, I want it to be even slower, and I want that soundtrack to be even more epic. And so that's what I did, you know. Worked a composer to make an epic soundtrack. I went super crazy on the slow motion and slowed it down 100 times so you could look at the suit properly, you know, and just sort of the cinematography to make it look filmic, almost like, you know, making a Spider-Man scene indoors in your living room. And then the presence of my family, it was. Yeah, it was kind of, you know, when you see the film, it can look humorous, and there is humor in it, you know, Spidey jumping in front of an Indian looking family. But there's also just truth in it, you know. I guess it probably came out before a whole bunch of the recent Spidey films. And so it's still, it's definitely before the Spideyverse was kind of out wider. When I was shooting that film, the idea of being a brown person as Spidey still generally was novel, even though it was in the comics, it just generally wasn't out there. And so that it's a very basic thing of saying, of course an Indian kid could grow up wanting to be Spider-Man. And he would have done it in that living room, with all of the things that Indian families have around,
You highlighted something interesting about the character of Spider-Man as well, because the suit is a full body suit. I think, as we know, in the up to at least the 90s, superheroes were just dominated by white faces, weren't they? And the but Spider-Man, I think, has transcended that. I mean, have you watched the new Spider-Verse films, I guess? And they're amazing, aren't they? They're genuinely amazing. I mean, it goes so meta, it's unbelievable, but they are a joy to watch. And it's in, what you say as well, like the I have two little daughters, 4 and 6, nearly 7. And every time they watch a show, they go like, "I'm that one, I'm that one." And they pick which one, whatever the show is, it doesn't matter. I'm that one. And then they're this embodiment, whether it be My Little Pony or Princess Power or whatever, they always pick which one they are. So tell me, I want to know about young Hattane. Where did you start out as an artist? What was it like growing up in Bolton in the 80s and 90s? How come you ended up doing this for a living?
Well, in some ways, I came a very traditional route. I was talking to a school group yesterday, and I kind of hope that's a good thing that I came a traditional route, because sometimes people see what I do and think, how'd you end up there? But actually, it's in a very, I think, understandable way, in that when I was at school, art for me was just drawing. I used to love to draw on paper, sketchbooks, whatever. I just used to do it all the time. And then, at different points in life, what art could be kind of transformed and expanded. So throughout my childhood, up to being, up to the end of A levels, it was all about drawing and then painting, stuff that everybody does, right? And I was good at it. And so it made me feel special, and made me feel like I was excelling. And it was a place for me to disappear into. I was a very shy, quiet kid, and so it was a place to just hermit and to disappear into and let your imagination run wild. And then when I went to did my foundation course and my degree in fine art, art became a place to think, and to think about the world, identity, how we live, and the medium that I started to use started to expand. I used to try different things and try to think about what it would be to express yourself differently, not just drawing, or what if that moved to photography, film, performance. I'd try things and see what felt right. And so I think probably those things have expanded over time. And each of those times, it's not like suddenly I was some sort of maverick at 10 and was making film installations and sculptures and all of that sort of thing. It's happened bit by bit. I was always scared to take a leap. I always had to take one. It was kind of like, when I come into the end of my degree and I was shooting photographs of myself, kind of quite physical ones, decorated ones. And my tutors were like, "Oh, you should do a film of this or a performance of this." I was like, no. No, just photographs." And I never did it. And it's only after my degree I started trying video and then slowly performance and those sort of things. So, and then humor didn't end up in my work till way later. And so I was always scared of these things. So I think along this whole journey, there's always fear. There's always these things that you feel that you could feel like, it's a bit like having a guilty pleasure. I know there's something in there for me, but I'm either a bit shy about it, or I'm ashamed of it, or I don't know if it's cool. I don't know if I'll be accepted for it. And then eventually it gets to a tipping point where it's like, but that keeps coming back. And I have to be honest with myself, and that has to go in the work. And so every now and again, there's a leap. And I think that's happened throughout my whole life.
Because you are something of a polymath. You know, you started with photography, you do film, you're now, an excellent dancer. I mean, when did the dance stuff start?
So I graduated in 2003 from Nottingham Trent, and I was living in Nottingham for about 10 years in total, and then the movement dance stuff probably started towards 2009, and well, no, I mean in video actually it started in 2007, and trying rhythmic stuff with my limbs to do with rhythm that was coming from Indian classical music. And then the thing that kind of shunted it up into another league really is I was making a performance in 2009 for a gallery space, New Art Exchange, as they were opening their new building in 2008 actually. And then ended up getting some support from Dance 4, who are now called Fabric, part of Dance 4 and Dance Exchange in Birmingham connected to be Fabric, but they were Dance 4 in Nottingham to start, for many years obviously. And they started supporting me and encouraging me. And so that what that did is allowed me to follow that line of inquiry of that kind of performance into the theatre. And it allowed me to be in the dance more in the dance world, seeing performances, experiencing all the incredible things that Dance Forward bring as part of Not Dance. And so that got me into that world and sort of encouraged me to practice that more. And so that's where that expansion started from.
So tell us a bit about your time in Nottingham. You would say 2003 to about 2009, 10.
Well, 2000 is when I came. That's when I started my fine art degree at Trent.
Yeah.
So 2000 to 2003, and then I stayed until 2011, I think. And even then, it was never a desire to leave Nottingham. I love Nottingham. It was just because my partner got a job in London, and hers was a really good full-time job there, and I was freelance, and so I went with her. But at the time, I was very adamant that I was a Nottingham East Midlands artist. I was doing well for myself, like. I love Nottingham, the transport links, the kind of the performance art scene that had been happening there, and there was just so many supportive artist groups, and yeah, it was just brilliant. I absolutely loved my time in Nottingham.
What kind of places were you hanging out with here? Were you watching films at Broadway? Were you Selectivist record shop still open then? Rock City gigs?
Yeah, do you know what? I probably didn't take advantage enough of what was around Nottingham. You know, if we were going out, probably after the student years, it'd probably maybe be somewhere in Hockley. And even then, not that often, just because like strapped for cash if you're an artist.
Yeah.
And so and actually I didn't go. Of course, I knew Broadway and went there sometimes, but I tended to go to the big multiplexes, the Showcase and things like that, just because the kind of films I was mainly into were the big Hollywood blockbusters, and I just wanted to see them on the biggest, loudest screens I could find. If I would come into the Centre to eat, I'd probably hit Wagamama's just around the corner from the cinema, do it in one, you know. But I even though the predominantly amount of time my time in Nottingham was not as a student, my most formative times were as a student. You know, it was just a place of discovery and becoming, and you know, my first time living away from home and making really close friends and the social aspect and becoming who I was going to become as a person, as an artist. And I think Nottingham was just such a great seedbed for that. Like it felt, yeah, it just felt good.
Where did you live? If you were at Trent, were you like based in the city or?
Well, when I was, yeah, I mean, it was in student accommodation first year was in Basford, and then when we
Maltings, was it
shared
the Maltings?
Maltings, yes, were you there?
No, I mean, I'm from Notts, so I studied away, but I know it
Ah.
well. Do you know Matt Berry studied there as well? I was based there.
Oh,
The
really?
voiceover guy. He's a bit older than you, I think. But
Okay.
he's another person who was in those old halls.
Right. Yeah, the Maltings. I mean, just brilliant time. So I was a student there, and then I stayed in Radford, just around the corner from the Art Exchange. New Art
Yeah.
Exchange. So I was there on Bentinck Road for a few years, and then after being a student, I moved back to my folks for a bit, and then I came back to Nottingham. And when I came back, it was in Arnold. I was in Arnold for a couple of years. Then I moved to Bulwell. So I was in Bulwell for the last few years. Yeah, so I moved around a bit.
Yeah, good bit of North Knots there.
Yeah.
So how often do you come back? Is this your first appearance in a while, isn't it, back here, I think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't get a chance to come back much, to be honest with you. I mean, and that isn't necessarily through any active choice. The way my life works is that I'm a freelance artist, and I'm one of many artists out there that fall into this bracket where, look at our CVs and we're doing big international, national stuff, awards, blah blah blah. But structure, finances, it's still hustle. So, I
Mm.
don't have a team. I work on my own. And so, I'm my own everything. And so the teams I work with is often project related, usually. And so that doesn't, so that means you don't get a lot of time to do stuff. So nearly all of my travel is because of work, doing shows, doing talks, touring work, all that sort of thing. So when I've come back to Nottingham, it's tended to be for work. And then what I try to do is see friends when I'm there. Like, Vina Ladwa is kind of like my second mom. And she's leads a Kathak dance school in Nottingham over many years, might be 30 years in by now. And I used to do stuff for them, but she just also has a wide community because she does kids workshops over the years as well. She seems to know everybody, and she's got a very like open door policy in her home. There's always people there eating and chilling, and so I try to see her anytime I visit. She's going to be away this time when I'm come for the show, but yeah, it's kind of I and then the New Art Exchange, they've supported me through the years, even when I moved away from Nottingham. So they're, been one of the great supporters of my work since the beginning of my career.
I mean,
And
they're still
so
totally smashing it, The work they do in this city is amazing. Not only I think they've just finished their open show, which is probably like 60 artists in that, and it was really that interesting, challenging work. There's a lot of, I think at the moment, I mean, we'll talk about some of this later, but we live in strange times, and there were some controversial, challenging things in there about politics, identity, and those things, and they don't shy away from it. And yet, at the same time, they're doing that. They're also feeding the community, like literally open kitchens, feeding their community. And this, I
right.
think it's really important to have this amazing art facility in, one of the most deprived areas of Nottingham and the UK, therefore,
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I remember like a few years back when I used to go there, and the director at the time, Skinder Hundal, I remember going in, and he would know everybody that came in, not just art people, but local residents, anyone who was sleeping rough and coming in for a bit of warmth, he would know them by name, like just that intention to be a space in that space and not what some galleries can be, feel like they just shipped in and just invite our audiences in.
And they do, I think they just have this connection where they bring, new artists through. The name escapes me, but there's an artist that they did a fellowship with who's recently been exhibited at the Contemporary as well, which is another great, space in
Yeah.
Nottingham, but it's not as grassroots to see, and I think the guy that I think from my knowledge, there's been one other artist maybe in all of the time of the contemporary that was a Nottingham artist, because it's an international gallery, you know? And to see them passing that through and getting getting artists into these bigger spaces is great. I mean, I didn't realize what part they played in your career really, but it's really heartening to know. And I think long may they continue to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I think it might have been the place for either my first or second ever exhibition, when it was the Art Exchange, when it was the building before this one. So yeah, they've played a really formative part in mine for sure. I mean, and then it's kind of it's a bit silly this the kind of discrepancy between New Art Exchange and Nottingham Contemporary. It's like it shouldn't be viewed that way. That New Art Exchange is grassroots, that Nottingham Contemporary is an international gallery. Like, I've never shown at Nottingham Contemporary, but even after winning awards and international, well, I'm still showing my shows were at New Art Exchange still, and so I feel a bit funny about that, to be honest.
Well, that's kind of a word. I mean, I'm not sure how their booking policy works, but I know they do work with New Art Exchange quite a lot now, and but yeah, interesting. So Knot Dance, I mean, it happens every 4 years. Is this your first time you've been involved in Knot Dance? I know you've worked with Fabric before and Dance
It's
Four,
not,
but
it's actually not that, I've done Knot Dance once or twice before, actually. Actually, the first time I showed, made a first ever performance, 10, I showed that at Lakeside Arts Centre. This might have been 2009. I have a feeling that was also part of Knot Dance.
right, yeah.
And then another show, I forget now whether it's American Boy or American Man, we also, which would have been more like 2015-ish. We also did as part of Knot Dance. So yeah, I've definitely done Knot Dance before, so it feels really good to be included as part of it. And as I say, Knot Dance was really important introduction for me in terms of particular kind of dance and performance, which was just incredibly exciting. That was introduced to me, and it was that was incredible that that was in the city.
Left Lion Magazine is Nottingham's free printed culture guide. We aim to shine a light on the city and its culture, each month bringing you between 40 and 56 pages of independent local events and culture-based journalism. Every month we distribute between 10 and 15,000 copies for free in over 300 venues across the county. For example, you can find copies in every local library, every Castle Rock pub, in all active Nottingham leisure centres, and in many other places besides. In line with our pledge to be a carbon neutral company, copies are delivered by our team on foot, by electric bike, or, if necessary, by vehicle. You can also read the full magazine online for free at leftlion.co.uk/magazine. If you'd like to promote your business or organisation with us, please visit leftlion.co.uk/advertise. And if you'd like to pitch us a story, please email editorial@leftlion.co.uk.
You've won quite a lot of awards for your work over the years. Film London Derek Jarman Award 2019, Best International Film Award from Kino der Kunst in 2020, Nottingham Creative Business Award in 2008. I think I might have been there because we actually won one the year after.
Great.
Do any of these awards stand out in particular as proud moments? And what do
I
awards
mean,
mean to you?
what do they mean? I mean, I guess they feel like acknowledgement or recognition for something that you're doing anyway, and not something you think about. It's like you just want to do it for the work because that's what you're obsessed by. So it feels like really heartwarming recognition, whether it's from a few panelists or whether it's an audience vote, and all of those sort of things. And so, yeah, I'm not going to lie and just say it doesn't mean anything, because it is, it is meaningful. Because also, making artwork, you want your work to connect. You want it to connect with people, and for it to, be part of people's lives and be part of a conversation, and so in a way, it's part of that for me. But in terms of one that stands out, I mean, In some ways, the Nottingham Business Award was a big one because I don't know if I've ever said this, but like, or in an interview, but I remember going to that awards. I was nominated for Visual Arts, and I when I was going to that award ceremony, I got dressed up, and I remember being across Market Square, and I could see the entrance, and I could see like bouncers all dressed up, and there's people dressed up going in, and I just felt like such an imposter, and I was like, oh God, I nearly went home. Because I could just imagine turning up at that door and them saying, "Not tonight, mate. You've got it wrong. You're not on the list." And I was just so feeling like that, and that I nearly didn't go in. And then in the evening, I won the Visual Arts Award, and then I won the overall award, and I was just like, I just couldn't believe that, to be honest with you. And so that definitely, that the feeling of that surprise definitely stayed with me. And then probably the Derek Jarman Film Award from film the Jarman Award from the Film London. That's another one as well because I think you sort of get typecast sometimes for your work, and sometimes I'm seen as a person who makes work about identity or British Asian this or that, and I'm not sure how comfortable I am with that. But this was an award about the medium that you work in. And even though I work across all different media, it was like celebrating that I make film. And it sort of put me in a room on a par in a conversation with loads of makers and artists that I admire and respect. And so the feeling of that was a big one.
So I've read that in 2021 you declined a British Empire medal. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Tell us about that.
I mean, like I said about awards, it was very flattering. And I completely, with massive gratitude, accept the sentiment of people putting me forward for that. And for me, it feels very meaningful that people would feel, me worthy of recognition or celebration in that way. But, also, I just couldn't bear the thought of the word empire.
Yes.
Letters behind my name. It's just gross. And when I was looking it up, and more apparently more and more people every year decline. It's an upward going trend of declining those things. I'm no trailblazer in that sense, and I was reading stuff about Benjamin Zephaniah and other people who turned down, and so I feel kind of two ways about it. I think I don't begrudge anyone who takes it. I get that we've also got to be represented in these places, but for me, I know all artists of any kind of profile, people look up to them and look them up and that sort of thing. So I think you also have to be sometimes where you can be an example of declining stuff like this. And so there's an ever-growing list of artists and people who decline these things. And I think it's important for people to know that we can do that. It's yeah, in an ideal world, you'd want everyone to decline it. But that's never going to happen. So, you just have to add to the list of people who do.
I mean, I think the work you do and the work of others, it helps someone like me, who's obviously, I've got white privilege. So when people, although we're both born and bred in the UK, vaguely around the same time, no one comes up to me and goes, "But where are you really from, mate?"
Yeah.
But I think it helps understand. I mean, it's similar to, have you seen the Riz Ahmed? I think it is Riz Ahmed's piece called The Poem. I think, it is where you're really from. It's so powerful. And those
Yeah.
themes are, well, I think they're important to represent different communities, but they're also important for people who want to listen and understand, to understand what it's like. Because you go like, oh God, that's not something I have to deal with.
Yeah.
How do you
Yeah.
feel about the world right now? Like it's a bit challenging, isn't it? With, we see the stuff that went on in London at the weekend, you see the rise of Trump, you know,
Yeah.
looking at it, I'm glad the election is in 2028, 29, because reform seems to be growing at this rate that scares the shit out of me.
Yeah.
How does it feel for
Yeah.
you?
I mean, it's like, I think probably when 2016 hit, when we're hitting Brexit, we're hitting the first entry of Trump. I think those were such massive paradigm shifts in my mind that I could never have imagined. That the ridiculousness of those things and the implications of them was so huge that it took so long to understand that that was real, that almost everything after that doesn't surprise me. Or, like, you know, just I don't even know what the feeling is. It's not apathy because it comes with rage, but then if you look at history, there's so many things that are cyclical and come back around. And you know, I went, you know, I was walking around in those on the edges of some of those marches on at the weekend, just because I wanted to see who the people were, and you know, just to remind myself physically how this exists. And it took me back to years ago. You know, it took me back to growing up where I grew up and the feeling that I had in my body, in my nerves at that time. And it's like it's just always been there in a different shape, in some form or other. You know, it's you just you almost don't know how to feel about it. Like it's kind of it overwhelms your senses and it makes you feel powerless. You know, it's like, you know, on one hand, you feel guilt about not posting about Palestine and genocide every single minute of every day. And then on the other hand, I have a lot of downtrodden pessimism where I'm like, we're just all in an echo chamber anyway. And can I even make it an iota of a difference? And so this kind of, and this, and sort of the rage that the people or organizations or governments or whatever that could make a difference are not, that could change this overnight if they wanted to. And so it's like it's this feeling of powerlessness and kind of sensory deadening somehow. And yeah, just trying to negotiate with yourself how you exist in the world and how you can make what you do still matter, or you know, you're sort of fighting those impulses in your mind that go, oh, it's not important, people are dying. And then, you know, the other side that kicks in and goes, no, we have to keep existing, we have to keep creating, we have to keep connecting, we have to keep putting stories out there and messaging about connectedness. And all of those things, and that we're in that sense, you're not doing it alone. You're part of a movement, and even if we're only able to do little bits each, it's still, you know, you hope that it adds up, you know.
I mean, I obviously I media is a big interest of mine, a lifelong interest as well. And I often look at it from a media angle. Now, I've given up on most big media, particularly big media that's owned by a human being, a tycoon or whatever, a long time ago, right? But I have a strong belief in, you know, community media and grassroots and things. And one and then, you know, I go through this constant thing of, well, you know, because we're a nice magazine, we cover nice things like culture and things like that, and we don't
Yeah.
really engage in news, politics and all that, but you can't help look at it sometimes and just go, well, you know, why is all this happening? I mean, for me at the moment, like the idea that, you know, I'm going to call out the BBC on this one. Like I'm a strong believer in the idea of the BBC as an idea, but their news coverage at the moment is, you know, if Keir Starmer gets a free suit, he's in the news for like 3 weeks. Whereas, you
Yeah.
know, you look at Nigel Farage's returns and go, well, if he's really against immigration, why is he getting 60 grand a year from economic migration charities, which is the elite rich
learning how to get 25 passports. And he's there doing talks going, I will help you get citizenship in return for money. And you just think there's a moral thing here that's, you know, and it should be on those front pages to me. This should be talked about, you know, this idea and the fact that right now we've got, like, you know, Trump visiting the UK. I don't know if you've seen it. I thought it was led by donkeys, but it's not. And there's brilliant banners that have been unveiled of him with Epstein on the Windsor Castle grounds. Just some, like, art terrorists have done this, and it's amazing. But it's not on the BBC. And there's, like, about a million stories about Trump's visit on the BBC. And this is a story about, you know, a 40-metre banner that someone's unveiled. And then for what, I don't know why they're not covering it. And it's really frustrating, you know. You just look at it and go, and all these things about people's money, like, sorry, I'm on a little rant here, but I'd like
you
to hear the
with you.
Sue Gray getting, you know, when she came in, it was all about how much money she was on, right? But all the reporters reporting this were on more money. And what they said, they were just on more money than her. And they said, well, we live in London waiting and all that. And plus, we're not civil servants like they are. We're not public servants. And you go, the way you are paid is more like those politicians than it is like anyone at The Sun. And don't get me wrong, I hate The Sun, right? But at the same time, that The Sun is a company, whereas we're all paying taxes that go to the BBC. And I'm a licensed fee payer, you know. So, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love local BBC, and I really do. But I'm very, like, confused and annoyed with how their reporting is at the moment and how everything is a snipe towards the, you know, what's wrong in the current government when they're not looking at this thing, really. And I think it, you know, Nottinghamshire recently returned a reform council, which is a nightmare. You know, it's like that's the greater Nottinghamshire, not the city centre. But and one of the first things they did was say they're not going to engage with local media. They just stopped it, basically. So it's Nottingham Live, which would have been the Evening Post when you're here. And don't get me wrong, that's a news organisation that's got its faults, but they've run a big campaign against this, going, we've got to engage with the press. And now what we've got is a government, like a local county level government, who are refusing to engage with the local newspaper and just say, no, we're not doing press conferences anymore.
Crazy.
Where's the accountability in this? You know?
I mean,
so there you go.
I mean, it's all about control. I mean, even why the BBC don't cover certain stuff, like they are terrified of inciting, you know, feeling people's anger and frustration building, and if they show those things, feeling that it'll bubble over, and they're scared of that. You know, it's kind of like the biggest thing when you look into human history, you know, one of the things that put us at the top of the food chain that other animals can't do is our ability unite. Our ability to not unite, mobilize, right? So in any instance where civil rights, women's rights, anything has passed a tipping point, it's been when people have been able to mobilize and been able to do something en masse together. And that's what all of the current social media, whatever, is so powerful at doing, is stopping people doing that. Is keeping people divided, making sure there's no tipping point of numbers, of energy, of dissident voices against government. That's the game, and it's so hard to fight against those sort of powers.
On to a nicer subject. Just before we started chatting, I watched your TED Talk, I mean, I don't know if you've done a few, but it was the one where you spoke in one paragraph in Chinese.
Yes.
It was really good fun. Like, I think you mentioned earlier that humor didn't come into your work till later on, but you know, that was fun, man. Like, do you ever do stand up?
No, I don't, but like, in a way, my performance career on stage came from a kind of stand up. I think in like 2008 or something, I had to do a best man speech for my friend at his wedding, and it was a mixed race wedding, and so all of the jokes I was sort of making there were about race and about identity and mixing and all of that sort of stuff, and it went so well, and that actually that's what gave me the courage to make a certain format of my performance that would be more theatrical, rather than durational gallery performance. And so yeah, so I've never dabbled in quite in stand up, but that's the closest I got. But I think humor is important. You know, I think when you're dealing with subject matter that could be quite volatile or things that could on the surface that be preachy, if you're actually genuinely interested in connecting with people, I think you've got to do it in languages that can drop people's guards or make people open up a bit, you know.
What do you do in your spare time when you're not making art? Do you get spare time?
I mean, not really. I mean, I'm quite low energy in my spare time, if you like. I probably just watch films and Netflix and you know, arguably that's not spare time, that's research towards my films. But you know, they're the kind of things that make me feel relaxed.
How up to date are you on the superhero films? Like, have you watched all of the Marvel, all of the?
Do you know what? In recent years, I struggle to engage with them, and the reason being is that when the whole wave started in early 2000s of the new waves, I feel like it was targeted to a slightly older audience. I think now all of them are really dipping in the age that they're targeting at, and I get it, profit, blah blah blah, but I think that feels less interesting for me. You know, like the almost some of the peak of it for me were some of the end game Marvel of Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy. You know, that's the level I love. You know, the recent Spider-Mans, I'm weird to say, I don't even know if I've seen all the recent Spider-Mans. Like, you know, a few of the more recent ones, they felt so kiddie, or which is, you know, which is fine, you want to engage other people, but I don't know if in my opinion, I don't know if they even need to be so kiddie to make it fine for kids. Like, you know, the Tobey Maguire films, surely they can be just as easily watched and loved and enjoyed by younger audiences, without needing to pander to, I don't know. So yeah, that's my slight superhero rant.
Well, the Marvel ones have obviously blazed the trail, but have you seen the new Superman film?
I have, yeah.
It's interesting, right? So they've turned him into an immigrant. And like, I didn't really, I've slept on DC films because frankly, all the Batfleck era, all of that, it was just a mess to me. I kind of turned it on and then turned it off. And I think it's, and I don't get to watch that much superhero or sci-fi stuff because my missus can't tolerate it at all at home. But some of those I couldn't really deal with, like that Zack Snyder era. But then this film is like it's a really interesting piece of work, isn't it? I thought, you've got Nicholas Holt as this kind of bad guy who's manipulating everybody, and he's brilliant in it as well. And then, I mean, I can't remember the name of the guy that's Superman, but I just think it's very well done to put him as the outsider, really, and that there's this whole very current theme of political angst directed towards Superman.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, weirdly, I felt a bit different to it. I mean, I went into that really, or came out of it really missing the magic of the sentiment of you will believe a man can fly. You know, and I get we've done origin story and that, but I kind of wanted origin story, or like, I don't know, there's like, it could be a very personal thing. It feels like there's so much heaviness in life and everything right now. I think I went into that wanting a bit of escapism, and just
I hear
like
that.
feeling the magic of, you know, some of a couple of the early films, I can't remember, whatever, or even not just all the superhero, you know, the moment of becoming, of feeling that magic of, oh my God, what it would feel like to see someone fly in a world where we've got no idea that superheroes exist. I think that's the magic I missed,
Yeah, I hear
somehow.
that. I mean, there is something to be said about that you almost don't want those two paths to cross too much, really.
Yeah, I don't
Yeah.
know, maybe. I mean, I could, there should be space for all of it, but like, I don't know. But I
I
also think
love
it's a good.
Crypto the dog though. Crypto the dog. I love the
Oh,
appearance of that
yeah,
dog. That was
agreed,
great.
agreed. Yeah.
Unexpected for me.
Yeah, for sure. That was good. That was good. But you know, it also, in some ways, I like picking films apart, or in the sense of like, it also gives me impetus to know what I want to make from my film. You know, when you feel dissatisfaction with stuff as a maker, often it's also guiding you towards what you do want to make, you know. So it's so I don't mind. I don't need to come out of all films loving them.
What are you working on at the moment? What's next for you? Because Mathew Bash has been, it's kind of been touring for about a year on and off, hasn't it?
Yeah, so that's kind of, and that's going into a development. So there's going to be different versions of that, and it's being supported by Fabric, and there's different versions of that. So I wanted to do like from very DIY to like, you know, you could go into a bar and put a track behind the bar, grab a mic, and just be able to do it there and then, you know, no, nothing needed, right through to the other end of main stage solo performance, but with a full symphony orchestra, potentially with other family members on stage, and so at the minute I'm currently working on multiple different versions of that, in early development, and then I'm working on a new ensemble dance piece, co-directing that with Pargrav Dance Company, who are based in Milton Keynes. I'm about to have some very exciting conversations about moving my feature film forward, which has been in, you know, early concept pipeline for a long time and been on pause for a while I was doing the Art Angel project, and so about to dive back into that,
Are you allowed to tell us what that is?
the feature film.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, I mean, if you were to look back at a couple of my recent films, there's a lot of clues in there. So a film I made called Trinity, which was at the New Art Exchange, when I showed there in recent years. It's about two young women that rediscover the first human language, and that this language becomes a key to setting humanity free. And so, yeah, it's kind of like with all of the short films that I make, it's featuring and about marginalized people, but with a soul in it that is about everybody. And you know, it's wanting to be on a big cinematic scale. I want to make my Matrix. And so that's where I'm aiming it.
And are you directing, starring in, bit of all of it?
Not gonna star in it. I'm gonna direct. Gonna direct. That's the. I honestly don't know how people direct, star, all of those things, in it. Like I get a massive buzz from directing it. You know, like it's such a collaborative art form, and getting to conceive of and develop everything from the ground up with amazing collaborators is you know, one of my favorite things to do, and it's something you don't get a chance to do much because it costs so much money. You know, like it's mad to think over the last 10 years since I've been making this kind of film, I've been on set for about 10 days. And people know me as a filmmaker. Do you know what I mean? It's like
Yeah.
you sort of work your ass off and die for those tiny moments you get on set.
Interesting. Well, hopefully we can have a chat again in about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years and about the cinema release and streaming or something of this
Yeah,
film, yeah?
sounds good. Sounds good.
Hiten Patel, everybody. So, Mathew Bashar is showing at the Lakeside Arts Centre on Saturday, the 1st of November, 2025. Tickets were still available at a very affordable £10 each at the time of recording this podcast. There's quite a lot of other things happening as part of Not Dance 2025 all across Nottingham too. Have a look at the October issue of Left Lion to find out more about other artists who are part of it, like Lucy Suggett and her show Tender Stones at Nottingham Contemporary on Wednesday the 8th of October. We also feature a show called We Move in Close Circles. That's by a collective of artists who are performing it in people's private homes from the 16th to the 18th of October. Hopefully the homeowners remember to tidy up beforehand. Then there's the show Not Dance as Place, where Fabric are inviting people to share their stories and become part of the performance. That's at the Fabric headquarters on Dakin Street, just off Carlton Road, near St Enton, on Saturday the 25th of October. For more details about Not Dance, please visit their website, notdance.com. So during my conversation with Hattain, I mentioned a Nottingham-based artist who I couldn't remember the name of, but who had been mentored at the New Art Exchange and gone on to be part of a show at the Nottingham Contemporary. That artist was Raheel Khan, and he was part of the exhibition Your Ears Later Will Know to Listen. That show ran from the 31st of May to the 7th of September this year. His piece was a series of metal bars shaped a bit like a xylophone on a wall in a big open room. I went to see and hear it, and it made noises at a strange pitch. I liked it. So did my kids. In this podcast, you'll have also observed me having a little rant about the current rise of nationalism and particularly the media coverage of it in this podcast. We like to keep things light in Left Lion magazine, but as the line between culture and politics blurs, these things become more important. Anyway, thanks to you, our listeners, for staying right till the end. Bye-bye.